From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I think the massacre of the innocents must obviously apply to both sides, though the Israeli dead have equal right to that claim, but the scale, I mean disproportionate is not the word for it, the scale of the response is obscene.
Robert Fisk, chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, reports from Beirut. Then rallies around the world opposing Israel's assaults on Gaza and Lebanon. We'll hear from some of the protesters here in the United States.
The situation is completely out of control. I have several aunts and my grandmother that are trapped in separate villages throughout southern Lebanon. They can't leave because the bridges have been completely blown.
And today, former Senator George McGovern turns 84. Ridiculed by the press and scorned by his colleagues, the 1972 presidential candidate stood alone on the Senate floor calling for an end to the Vietnam War.
Young boys without legs or arms or genitals or faces or hopes, don't talk to them about bugging out or national honor or courage. It doesn't take any courage at all for a congressman or a senator, or a president, to wrap himself in the flag and say, we're staying in Vietnam because it isn't our blood that is being shed.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli attack on Lebanon has entered its second week. Early this morning, Israeli airstrikes killed at least 54 civilians in a series of raids in southern Lebanon. Another 37 people were killed on Tuesday. The death toll now stands at about 300, nearly all Lebanese civilians. Over the past week, Israel's attacked more than 100 villages, towns, and cities across Lebanon. Early this morning, Israeli ground troops have crossed back into Lebanon to carry out attacks near the southern border. The Israeli government has yet to rule out staging a massive ground invasion. For the first time, Israeli soldiers exchanged heavy fire with Hezbollah fighters inside Lebanon. Israeli tanks have also recrossed into Gaza. The humanitarian crisis in Lebanon continues to worsen. At least 500,000 people have been displaced from their homes. Scores of roads and bridges have been hit, making it hard to transport food or humanitarian aid. Recent Israeli strikes have targeted Lebanon's largest milk factory, a major food factory, and two pharmaceutical plants. Earlier bombs hit water processing plants, power plants, and grain silos. On Tuesday, a convoy of two trucks carrying medical supplies donated by the United Arab Emirates was hit. The trucks were destroyed. Both drivers died. The Israeli military has denied targeting the factories or aid trucks. Two ambulances were also bombed Tuesday. They were carrying Lebanese soldiers who were injured in an Israeli attack on their base that had killed 11 Lebanese soldiers. A Greek Orthodox church also suffered a direct hit. Inside the church were civilians who'd taken refuge. At least 10 people were injured. Lebanon's Prime Minister Fuad Senyora accused Israel of committing massacres against Lebanese civilians and working to destroy everything that allows Lebanon to stay alive. Another Lebanese cabinet minister accused Israel of waging a war to inflict famine in Lebanon. The Beirut Bar Association has begun discussing plans to file a complaint with the United Nations against Israel for committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. Meanwhile, Lebanon's Prime Minister Senyora called on the militant group Hezbollah to free the two Israeli soldiers it captured last week. On Tuesday, Hezbollah continued to fire missiles into northern Israel. One person was killed and several others were injured. Human Rights Watch accused Hezbollah of violating international law by firing the missiles at civilians. Hezbollah rocket attacks have killed 25 Israelis, including 13 civilians. Human Rights Watch also called for an investigation into Israel's attacks in Lebanon. The Bush administration has openly rejected calls for a ceasefire. The New York Times reports that U.S. and Israeli officials have agreed the bombings will continue for another week. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice rejected an immediate ceasefire and said one could only occur once certain conditions are met. During a joint news conference in Washington, she openly disagreed about the issue with the Egyptian foreign minister, Abu Qaid.
Ceasefire is imperative, And we have to keep working to reach that objective. It is imperative. We have to bring it to an end as soon as possible. Thank you.
We all agree that it should happen as soon as possible when conditions are conducive to do so.
Egyptian Foreign Minister Ahmed Abu Ghraït and Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State. She's expected to head to the Middle East within the next week, but no official plans have been announced. According to the Wall Street Journal, her mission will not be to arrange for a ceasefire, but to, quote, build support for the effective crippling of Hezbollah. Meanwhile, President Bush defended Israel's attacks and placed the blame on Syria.
Everybody abhors the loss of innocent life. On the other hand, what we recognize is that the root cause of the problem is Hezbollah. And that problem must be addressed. And it can be addressed through internationally by making it clear to Syria that they've got to stop their support to Hezbollah. Syria's trying to get back into Lebanon, it looks like to me.
President Bush said the world cannot allow Hezbollah's attacks on Israel to continue.
Sometimes it requires tragic situations to help bring clarity in the international community. And it is now clear for all to see that there are terrorist elements who want to destroy our Democratic friends and allies. And the world must work to prevent them from doing so.
On Capitol Hill, the U.S. Senate unanimously passed a resolution endorsing Israel's military attack and condemning Hezbollah as well as Iran and Syria. The House is expected to approve a similar resolution. Last night, Republican National Committee Chair Ken Mellman declared, quote, "Today we are all Israelis," during a speech to the organization Christians United for Israel. At the United Nations, U.S. Ambassador John Bolton said there was no moral equivalence between the civilian casualties from the Israeli raids in Lebanon and those killed in Israel from what he called malicious terrorist acts. He maintained Israel's only been acting in self-defense. Meanwhile, the Bush administration's coming under increasing criticism for being too slow to evacuate U.S. citizens stranded in Lebanon. Thousands of Europeans have been evacuated, but only a few hundred Americans have been able to leave. A total of 25,000 U.S. citizens are believed to be in Lebanon. In Gaza, Israeli tanks have crossed back in actions today. Israeli troops killed 9 Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Around 100 Palestinians have been killed since late June. This is Nabila Bouredina, the senior aide to Mahmoud Abbas.
To find a way in order to stop this Israeli escalation on the ground. This is the main topic. This is what we were looking for. Apart from the humanitarian crisis which the Palestinian people are suffering. We hope that the United Nations will continue their efforts to stop this escalation, this military-Israeli escalation, and to help and support the Palestinian people facing the difficulties and the hardship of the situation.
Nabila Bouredina, senior aide to Mahmoud Abbas. In Iraq, the United Nations has determined about 6,000 Iraqi civilians were killed in the months of May and June, making it the deadliest period of the war. This means an average of 100 Iraqis are dying every day. The UN figures are based on data from Baghdad Morgue and the Iraq Health Ministry. On Capitol Hill, the Senate voted Tuesday to expand federal support of medical research using embryonic stem cells. President Bush has vowed to veto the legislation. The bill received the support of 63 senators, short of the two-thirds majority it would take to override the veto. So far during his presidency, President Bush has not vetoed any legislation. Opponents of stem cell research claim conducting medical experiments on fertilized human eggs amounts to ending human lives. On Tuesday, Democratic Senator John Kerry urged Bush not to veto the legislation.
Americans have been presented with a false choice between the sanctity of human life and the scientific knowledge that can save it. The president's veto rests on a false assumption that we have to choose between our dreams and our principles. I believe, Mr. President, we can have both and we can protect both.
Pennsylvania Republican Rick Santorum voted against research on stem cells, saying it was the equivalent of taking a human life.
That every life, whether it's in a suspended state in an IVF clinic, or whether it's standing on the floor of the United States Senate attempting to defend and protect those suspended lives, every life has meaning. Every life deserves protection under our Constitution.
Close to three-quarters of Americans support stem cell research. On Tuesday, reporters asked Press Secretary Tony Snow why Bush opposed the bill. Snow responded, quote, "The simple answer is he thinks murder is wrong." In another vote on Capitol Hill, an effort by House Republicans to pass a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage has failed. In Indonesia, the death toll from Monday's tsunami has risen to at least 520. An investigation has been launched to determine why residents of Java received no warning that a six-foot-high wall of water was approaching the island. In New Orleans, a doctor and two nurses have been arrested in connection with the deaths of four patients in the days following Hurricane Katrina. Louisiana Attorney General Charles Foti accused them of using lethal injections to kill the four patients.
This is not euthanasia. This is plain and simple homicide.
The medical personnel worked at the Memorial Medical Center. The hospital lost power after the hurricane, and patients had to wait 4 days to be evacuated. The doctor and two nurses have not yet been formally charged. Last fall, the state of Louisiana launched an investigation into the deaths of at least 140 patients at six Louisiana hospitals and 13 nursing homes. In Washington, D.C., Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez revealed Tuesday that it was President Bush himself who blocked Justice Department lawyers from investigating the legality of the administration's secret domestic surveillance program. The National Journal reports Gonzalez's statement stunned some senior Justice Department officials who are led to believe that Gonzalez made the decision. Bush blocked the Justice Department investigation of the National Security Agency program by denying necessary security clearances to investigators from the department's ethics unit. In media news, the former editor of Time magazine is set to become a senior advisor to the Carlyle Group. The investment company is reportedly stepping up its ownership of media companies. It's part of a consortium that recently bought VNU, owner of Nielsen Media Research and Hollywood Reporter. And in Georgia, Ralph Reed has failed in his attempt to become the state's lieutenant governor. The former head of the Christian Coalition lost Tuesday's Republican primary to a little-known state senator named Casey Cagle. In other news from Georgia, Congressmember Cynthia McKinney is facing an uphill battle in her bid for re-election. She won Tuesday's Democratic primary, but failed to secure 50% of the vote. She now faces a runoff on August 8th against Hank Johnson, a former county commissioner. McKinney is the first African-American woman to be elected to Congress and has been a vocal critic of the Iraq War and the Bush administration's handling of Hurricane Katrina. Again, the first African-American woman from Georgia to be elected to Congress. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli attack on Lebanon has entered its second week. The death toll now stands at about 300, nearly all Lebanese civilian. The humanitarian crisis continues to worsen with hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes. For a report from Lebanon on the crisis today, we turn to journalist Robert Fisk. He's the chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. He's lived in Beirut for almost three decades. He's the author of Pity the Nation, The Abduction of Lebanon. His latest book is The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. We reached him late yesterday at his home in Beirut. He spoke about the Israeli assault on Lebanon.
What's happening is obviously the mass punishment of a whole people, the Lebanese, in response to the capture of two Israeli soldiers and the killing of three others on Wednesday of last week. The death toll now has just topped 240 in the last few minutes. Almost all of the Lebanese dead are civilians, of course, as usual. The Americans, in the usual pusillanimous way of Mr. Bush, are doing nothing to prevent this taking place. It amazes me. I mean, living here in Beirut, as I have for 30 years, here are the Lebanese people, sophisticated, educated, a cosmopolitan, people who don't look like the Arab world. They look like us. I mean, people who could be quite at home on the streets of Paris or New York and London, and some of them are people who read, who are very well educated, are people who speak English fluently, French beautifully, and fluent Arabic as well, of course, and who, when they die in such large numbers, the best we can produce is a call for restraint by the State Department and a claim by the British, our own dear Tony Blair, that the Israelis are using disproportionate force. The exchange rate for mutual slaughter between Israel and here at the moment is now 1 to 10, 24 Israelis, I think 25 now, to 242 Lebanese, many of whom, as I say, most of whom, but the far largest proportion are civilians. Many Beirut people were very moved Saturday when the Lebanese Beirut newspapers carried a very, very tragic picture of a young girl, a little girl, must have been 4 or 5 years old, near a place called Tel Halfa, lying dead in a field in her blue pajamas, looking, as I said in my newspaper, very similar to that terrifying picture from Poland in 1939 of the little Polish girl lying dead with her weeping sister beside her. I did receive a phone call today from an Israeli woman living in the East Coast of the United States, who said she thought that what was being done to the Lebanese was unforgivable. I thought she was a very generous and good woman, saying she prayed for the Lebanese people and the Palestinians, and for the Israelis, of course. But it's a tragedy of immense proportions because, of course, it's also tearing apart a country. In the last 24 hours, we found the Israelis have turned to attacking a milk factory, Libanais, the factory that produces the milk I drink every morning in my tea, a paper box factory, for heaven's sakes, hardly a terrorist target. We've already seen them smash up the runways of Beirut Airport and destroy part of most of the lighthouse, the new lighthouse in Beirut. The Israelis today even attacked the factory which imports Procter & Gamble goods here. We've had an ambulance convoy, a convoy of new ambulances from the United Arab Emirates crossed from Syria into Lebanon and got attacked from the air. It's an all-out war against the economy infrastructure of a country that was at last beginning to look modern again after the 15 years of civil war, which cost 150,000 lives. And it's very sad to see. You know, I think the massacre of the innocents must obviously be applied to both sides. The Israeli dead have equal right to that claim. But the scale, I mean, disproportionate is not the word for it, the scale of the response is obscene. Even a small example I'll give you. Yesterday, something fell out of the sky over a small area of Beirut called Kfar Shim. I think it was part of the wingtip of an F-16. The Israelis say it's not, but I think it probably was. And it crashed in a fiery volcano glow and burned trees, bushes, the roadway, and decapitated a young man in his car who was driving home to his family. I got there in about 8 minutes, and there were three very friendly Lebanese soldiers, and by chance I knew one of them, the sergeant, who said, "Mr. Robert, you must be very careful. The Israelis will come back and bomb again, but we'll take you into the fire and show you as much as we can." And they stood round me and protected me as we went up the road for about a mile walking, or running, to be very honest with you, because Mr. Fisk here is not a very brave warrior. And I saw parts of what appeared to be a wing. I think there was burning fuel all over the road. I think it came out of this, whatever the aircraft was. I think what actually happened is that a Hezbollah missile probably hit an F-16 and the Israelis didn't want to claim it. They said that it was part of a barrel containing propaganda pamphlets and leaflets, which, well, I didn't see leaflets anyway. I don't think they burn on fuel. But anyway, I saw what I could and got away afterwards and said, you know, waved at the soldiers and thanked them. And the Israelis did come back some hours later and bombed the barracks of these soldiers, which were members of a logistics unit. Their job was to repair bridges and electrical lines. They weren't combat soldiers. And they killed 10 Lebanese soldiers, including the three young men who had protected me the previous day. This was outrageous because the Israelis know what each individual Lebanese army unit is doing. They know if it's a combat unit, armored personnel, carriers, helicopters, whatever. And they picked on this sole barracks to destroy those men, to exterminate them, because, of course, their job was to keep Beirut alive, to keep power systems running, to repair the bridges, which are being destroyed. 46 bridges now, according to the Minister of Finance, who told me this a few hours ago, have been destroyed in Lebanon. This is the inheritance, of course, of former Prime Minister, assassinated Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, who was murdered on 14th of February last year. He rebuilt this country. He rebuilt the city of Beirut. And now, bit by bit, the bridges, the lighthouse, the international airport are being destroyed.
when Robert Fisk was almost killed by an angry Afghan mob when he was covering the war in Afghanistan. Rafiq Hariri called him after he had gotten out of that situation, almost died, and asked if he could send a plane. But Robert Fisk said he felt that was inappropriate to receive anything from a government or former government official. Well, on Tuesday, the Lebanese prime minister said Israel is opening the gates of hell and madness in his country and urged Hezbollah to release the two captured Israeli soldiers, but said Israel's response has been disproportionate. I asked Robert Fisk about the prime minister's comments.
I know Fouad Siniora, the Lebanese prime minister, quite well, and I like him very much, and he's a very affable, friendly, and honorable man. But his response has been pretty pathetic. To call the Israeli response disproportionate is to go along with the European, the EU's equally pusillanimous response. Roaring on about gates of hell is not something that Lebanese prime ministers can do. He appeared on television not long ago crying, which I don't think Winston Churchill was doing in May of 1940. But he's not Rafiq Hariri and never claimed to be. He's an economist, not a professional politician. The usual problem, the moment the attack took place, the Israelis blamed the Lebanese government, who can't even control a water faucet, let alone a Hezbollah militiaman. And that, by saying the Lebanese were responsible, gave them the excuse to start destroying the infrastructure of Lebanon. Even the beautiful new viaduct that Hariri had built on the transnational highway to Syria has been broken by the Israeli bomber strikes. I've been there and seen it and stood on it. What it needs is a government there's no power in the Lebanese army. It's 50,000 strong, but they can't defend Lebanon. And there's only three Vietnam-era helicopters and some ancient Hawker Hunter fighters belonging to Lebanon. They can't fight off the Israelis. But, I asked tonight, for example, the Minister of Finance whether he's considered suing the major American armaments manufacturers who are producing the missiles who are killing all these innocent people here. And he hadn't thought of it. most of the missiles which are landing here are made in Seattle and in Miami, Florida, by Lockheed Martin or Boeing. But it's as if you've got this little tiny parish council, parish pump government, and they talk about the gates of hell, and then they talk about disproportionate, and then they cry. I'm afraid that's not a way to run a country, but Lebanon is a very small, weak country. And Israel is a nuclear-armed superpower. What can you do?
Robert Fisk speaking from his home in Beirut late Tuesday night. We'll come back to the interview in a minute. On to Beirut by Marcel Khalife. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to our interview with Robert Fisk, chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. Reached him at his home late last night in Beirut, where he has lived for almost three decades. I asked him about the World Health Organization's announcement Monday that it expects the number of Lebanese residents displaced from their homes to reach 900,000.
I think it's probably a little bit less than 900,000, but it's probably moving towards 500,000. The people from the southern suburbs, where, of course, the Hezbollah did have their headquarters, it being the Optimum word now, there are about 500,000 of them scattered across Beirut in schools, public parks. They're living out in the open in parks. Well, it's warm, but what a filthy place to live, under trees, on dried grass. This is the mass punishment of a whole people. For for the actions of a very ruthless, powerful guerrilla army, the Hezbollah, which does not represent Lebanese people. You know, it is important to remember that the Hezbollah crossed that border against all international law. No one gave them a referendum or a vote to cross the border and kill Israelis and capture two Israelis and start off this war. But you see, they totally relied upon the cruelty of Israel's response, and Israel, as usual, obliged them. So no one will now criticize the Hezbollah in Lebanon. But it's a catastrophe, because here is a country that began to believe in itself again after the years of civil war. And now it's the same old story. The country is being vandalized and smashed up by a country which says it believes in purity of arms. And these civilian deaths, I don't believe that they're by chance. I don't believe it was a mistake when they hit that army barracks of logistics soldiers who are trying to repair their own country, which they have every right to do. And Marwahin is a particularly, this is the village in southern Lebanon where on Saturday the Israelis ordered the villagers out. I should add that this is the village closest to the scene of the killing and capture of the Israeli soldiers on Wednesday. They were ordered to leave the village. They did so in a convoy of cars, 20 of them. They went to the United Nations, who ordered them away, Ghanaian battalion, shamefully, and set off to Tyre, and an F-16 came down and burned them all alive with bombs. Outrageous massacre. The Israelis keep boasting that they are picture-perfect, punctilious, surgical strike operations. Well, if that's true, then that was mass murder and a war crime. If it's not true, then we can't believe in the riff-raff of the Israeli Air Force anymore. It's as simple as that. Or the riff-raff of the Hezbollah, if you listen to some of their roaring, by the way. But one has to be as cynical and as critical as one wants in a war, because no one else will be, usually.
Robert Fiss speaking to us from his home in Beirut. On Tuesday, we broadcast an interview with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and I asked Robert Fisk about this, but I want to play for you just an excerpt of that interview that we played yesterday, done by independent journalist Rhys Erlich in Damascus. Erlich asked President Assad about whether Syria plans to demarcate its borders with Lebanon or open embassies between the two.
The first part about the borders, we had a formal letter from the Lebanese Prime Minister, and we sent him a formal reply, that we are ready to demarcate the borders. We don't have any problem, because we have such problem with Jordan a few years ago, and we solved it. About the embassies, as a concept, we cannot say you don't want to have embassy in another country, as concept, but that needs a normal relation. Now we don't have this normal relation with the Lebanese. So it needs better relation to discuss this issue.
What kinds of issues would have to be resolved in order to have normal relations?
First of all, not to have a government that works against your country. This first of all. And second of all, you need the Syrians to feel that they have real neighbors, not a cradle for, or not a hub for terrorists to come and do such terrorist acts in Syria.
One last question. What would it take to improve relations between the United States and Syria now? Are there any steps that could be taken that would improve?
Definitely by the United States, not by Syria, because we did a lot and we couldn't get any result because they don't have the will. So first of all, they should know, and they should understand the situation in the region. They should appreciate the role of Syria in the region. They should know that we have common interest that they don't see. And I think they should be neutral in dealing with our causes. That's how we can get back our relation to normal.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad speaking with independent journalist Rhys Erlich last month in Damascus. The full interview is available on our website at democracynow.org. Well, during our conversation yesterday with journalist Robert Fisk, I asked him about what role he thinks Syria and Iran are playing in the current crisis.
They are behind all of it. Look, last year, as I say, we're all coughing these days. Last year, under UN Security Council Resolution 1559, Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, was forced to make a very humiliating military withdrawal of his army from Lebanon. Since then, he's been constantly condemned by the State Department, the Pentagon, the White House, Israel, of course, as a bastion of evil, as helping the insurgents of Iraq, which up to a point I think he probably does. And Lebanon has been allowed to believe, especially by the U.S. ambassador here, Feltman, who is now mutely and pusillanimously silent, that it was a democracy, that it had won its freedom. The Cedars Revolution, remember, from last year, which is actually a State Department quotation. It wasn't made up by the Lebanese. And now, suddenly, this democracy counts for nothing. Because, of course, what President Assad has done effectively is say, look, you may think you have your little cedar democracy over there, but I control events. Syria is the chief supporter, politically, of the Hezbollah. And Iran is the chief supporter militarily of the Hezbollah. And this is Syria's work. This is Syria saying, we're back, we control events, negotiate over the occupied Golan Heights. And as usual, poor old Lebanon and the poor old Lebanese are paying the price for it. But you need to realize this was planned a long time ago. No one suddenly got up in the morning and ate their hummus and had some coffee and said, let's fire a missile at a warship. The teleguided missile attack on a major Israeli naval vessel had been planned a long time in advance. And militarily for the Hezbollah, it was an enormous success. It set the vessel on, the ship set on fire for hours, and four sailors were blown overboard. And since then, I have to tell you, I've only seen one gunboat off the coast of Lebanon, and that was miles away. They didn't come in close anymore, not at least during daylight hours. At another point, which the Israelis have not talked about because it's under strict censorship in Israel, the Hezbollah, who had weeks earlier sent a pilotless reconnaissance drone over Israel, made, of course, in Iran, taking pictures, they had identified the headquarters of Israel's top-secret military air traffic control center at Miron in northern Israel. This is a place where the military scientists are based inside caves in a mountain. They're untouchable. But the drone identified the antenna on the top of the mountain and put missiles onto it. Israel has a secret code name of Operation Apollo. Now, this was an extraordinary breach of Israeli security. Never, as far as I know, since the 73 wars, have been breached like this. And now, of course, now we're having these constant flurries of Fajr 2 missiles onto Haifa. An amazing situation, which, of course, is frightening, or not frightening, but is deeply concerned, worrying to the Israeli security people.
I went on to ask Robert Fisk about Hezbollah and the reaction in Lebanon to their capturing the two Israeli soldiers, which sparked the current crisis. Hezbollah has called for a prisoner swap with Israel, and many in the Arab world see their act as having been in solidarity with Hamas taking a soldier hostage in Gaza last month. I asked Robert Fisk to respond.
Obviously, Hezbollah knew when they carried out this attack across the border on Wednesday that the soldier had been captured and taken into the Gaza Strip. But I think it's expecting a bit much in terms of coordination to assume that this was some massive plot by both Hamas and Hezbollah. I don't believe so for a moment. Initially, the Lebanese reaction was great fury at Hezbollah because they realized that all this enormous forward movement of the country, the infrastructure, the money, the security, the safety, had all been thrown away. But the Hezbollah, as I said, had obviously relied upon the cruelty of the Israeli response, the extent of the cruelty of it, to make sure that at the end no one was going to criticize Hezbollah. And as I say, the Israelis obliged. Their response has been outrageous. It's been obscene. And, you know, we've now got more dead than we had in 96 when the Qana massacre happened. Many more dead than in 93. Now, it's not the same as, for example, the 1982 invasion of Lebanon, where 17,500 people were killed. We're only talking about just over almost 250. But nonetheless, many Lebanese now, you see, don't have an experience of that civil war and that earlier invasion. They're young. And many Lebanese, during the Civil War, were sent away to be educated in Harvard, New York, London, Geneva, Paris. And they came back believing in a new world in the West. And they're suddenly seeing what Israel is doing. And it is shattering. And when they look around and ask what the Americans are doing, well, the Americans are evacuating their precious American citizens, and the British are evacuating their precious English British citizens, and the French, and so on. We're more concerned about the lives of our beautiful blue-eyed white people than we are about the poor old Lebanese. And this is a big problem, you know, because the Lebanese are very sophisticated people. They look like us. They feel like us. They speak foreign languages. They're much more better educated than most Westerners. And we don't care about them. We don't care about them.
Finally, Robert Fisk went on to talk about the media coverage of the current crisis and reporters embedded in the Israeli military.
There were reporters embedded in the Israeli Navy watching them shell the coast of Lebanon, and I've seen the footage. Then suddenly, one of those Hetz-class gunboats is hit by an Iranian missile. And within a minute, Hezbollah's television station, Al-Manar, which has been totally bombed, pulverized, pounded into dust, is still broadcasting, presumably from bunkers elsewhere in Beirut, suddenly shows all the embedded footage on television. Like, here's the ship, here it is firing on southern Lebanon, this is the ship we hit. Extraordinary bit of propaganda. I mean, absolutely amazing, outrageously so. How on earth did they have those pictures aligned and ready to put out in the air within a few minutes of the attack on the gunboat? You know, Nasrallah came on television in Beirut within minutes after the Israelis had bombed his home and tried to kill him, and of course failed to do so, saying, you don't have to worry about me, but go out onto the beach of Beirut and look out to sea and you will see the ship burning. My goodness me, that was a stunning piece of propaganda. But of course, the embedded reporters, as usual, will do their job in extolling the, I'm sure, the surgical strikes of the Israelis. As usual, I put that in quotation marks. But, you know, there is an awful lot of propaganda and roaring on and on. I get very tired of watching Nasrallah saying it'll be all-out war, we have more surprises, etc. And then Ehud Olmert says we may have a full-scale land invasion of Lebanon, which is absolute tosh. He's no intention of doing that. He'd lose hundreds of men if he did such a thing. And there are all these sort of, I call them the roarers. You know, Nasrallah and Ehud Olmert are now trying to outdo each other in all kinds of, you know, terror language. I'm constantly reminded of that wonderful line in King Lear, where he says, I shall do such things I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. And I'm contemplating a piece on the roarers of the Middle East. Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, is another roarer. And, of course, the worst thing is that they say this so that the Western press will pick it up. And heaven spare us all, the Western journalists do pick it up and use it. You know, they're looking for a good line, as if this is a football match or a football game or a hockey match instead of a tragic war, which is taking the lives of people like that little girl in the field.
Robert Fisk, chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. He's covered the Middle East for the last three decades. He was speaking from his home late last night in Beirut, Lebanon. This is Democracy Now! As we turn to the protests that are happening around the world in response to Israel's assault on Lebanon and Palestine, from San Francisco to Cairo, Montreal to Rome. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets to call for an end to Israeli aggression in the Middle East. On Tuesday, hundreds gathered in the street in front of the Israeli mission in New York City. Protesters demanded an end to the U.S. support of Israel's attacks and freeing all Palestinian prisoners. Some of the speakers directly criticized New York Senator Hillary Clinton for her remarks at a pro-Israel rally on Monday. Here's what Hillary Clinton had to say.
We will support her efforts to send a message to Hamas, Hezbollah, to the Syrians, to the Iranians, to all who seek death and domination instead of life and freedom, that we will not permit this to happen, and we will take whatever steps are necessary.
Democracy Now! Producer Yuba Richens spoke to some of the protesters who came out yesterday in New York. This is Jane Toby, who came from upstate New York to take part in the protest.
I'm Jewish, and I'm here because I feel that the Jewish community needs to talk out, to speak out against the crimes that the U.S. government and the Israeli government is perpetrating against the people in Palestine, committing genocide in Gaza and killing people in Lebanon.
Well, the New York protests brought together Orthodox Jews, Palestinians, and other American activists. Many Lebanese Americans also attended in support of family members still in Lebanon. This is Maimana Farhat, also speaking at the protest in New York.
I was born in this country. country, but my father was born in southern Lebanon, and I've been going to southern Lebanon every year for the past 12 years.
What are you hearing from family members there?
The situation is completely out of control. I have several aunts and my grandmother that are trapped in separate villages throughout southern Lebanon. They can't leave because the bridges have been completely blown up, so there's no exit out of the villages. They're afraid of food running out within the next week because the populations of like each village are anywhere from 10,000 to 20,000 people, and they have maybe like 4 grocery stores for the whole village. My cousin was living in Dahe, which is the southern suburb of Beirut that's been bombarded so much. She was able to escape yesterday, thank God. When she escaped, she looked and saw that the majority of Dahe was completely leveled.
Another large protest took place Tuesday in Dearborn, Michigan. When we come back from our break, we'll talk to the editor and publisher of the Arab American News, one of the organizers of the protest. Stay with us. Scream by Marcel Khalifa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 450 radio and television stations around North America, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We are also podcasting at democracynow.org. As we turn now to another large protest that took place Tuesday, this in Dearborn, Michigan, the city home to the largest Arab American population in the United States. Nearly 10,000 people marched through the center of the city to demand U.S. pressure Israel to halt the attacks on Lebanon and Gaza. One of the organizers joins us now from Michigan. Osama Sablani is publisher and editor-in-chief of the Dearborn-based weekly bilingual newspaper, The Arab American. He helped found the Arab American Political Action Committee in Dearborn and the Congress of Arab American Organizations. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Osama Sablani.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. You are Lebanese?
Yes.
What word do you have from your family?
Well, I talked to my family yesterday. They are fine. I'm concerned about my family, but I'm concerned about the Lebanese people in general. As much as I'm concerned about my family, I tell you frankly, I called my family to ask them about the situation in Lebanon more than I called them to ask about themselves.
Well, what do you understand right now is happening on the ground?
Well, you know, I heard your interview with Robert Fisk. I think he described it pretty eloquently, that what's happening on a massive scale. There are massacres being committed against civilians in villages in the south. He talked about Marwahin massacre. There are others in Tyre that happened yesterday that totally killed an entire family, a bomb that landed on their home by the Israeli military forces. Israelis are just raping Lebanon right now and destroying its infrastructure. You know, Robert Fisk, you know, alluded to all these things. What I wanted to talk more is about what the United States have been doing in order to encourage the Israelis rather than discouraging them from going on and destroying Lebanon and killing innocent civilians. The president's remark is, in my opinion, we reject it. And it is unfortunate that the President of the United States makes such a statement when he says that it's going to take sometimes the loss of innocent life in order to bring the issues to the forefront. I mean, this is what Osama bin Laden will do, killing 3,000 Americans in order to bring his issues to the forefront. Killing innocent civilians is justified by the President of the United States, the only superpower, the leader of the only superpower of the world. This is disgusting. It is disgusting. This is Nazis' approach.
Osama Soleimani, I wanted to read you from the Guardian newspaper on this issue of U.S. policy. The piece reads today, the U.S. is giving Israel a window of a week to inflict maximum damage on Hezbollah before weighing in behind international calls for a ceasefire in Lebanon, according to British, European, and Israeli sources. The Bush administration, backed by Britain, has blocked efforts for an immediate halt to the fighting initiated at the U.N. Security Council, the G8 summit in St. Petersburg, and the European Foreign Ministers meeting in Brussels. U.S. strategy in allowing Israel this freedom for a limited period has several objectives, one of which is to deliver a slap to Iran and Syria, who Washington claims are directing Hezbollah and Hamas militants from behind the scenes. Your response?
Well, this is the incompetence of the U.S. administration, in particular the Bush administration. We have seen this incompetency in several places. Katrina is one. Iraq, a massive incompetence. This is the peak of incompetence. Now, again, we're seeing it in Lebanon. Giving another week to destroy Hezbollah. Hezbollah is getting stronger in Lebanon because every time you kill innocent people by Israeli, American-made bombs, people will be angry at Israel, at America. They will not be angry at Hezbollah. Hezbollah has not been affected in here. The Lebanese people who are being killed indiscriminately by bombs from Israel, and therefore they're supporting Hezbollah because Hezbollah is retaliating, trying to protect the country. And they have to get it into their head that this is not helping the situation. This shows one more time that we have a president who is incompetent, led by another incompetent prime minister in Israel. And we're leading the world into a disaster.
I wanted to ask you about Arab American reaction. Over 100 Arab American leaders from around the country are traveling to Washington today to meet with congressional leaders and State Department officials. The Lebanese American Congress members, Nick Rahal of West Virginia, Daryl Issa, Republican from California, Ray LaHood, Republican from Illinois, Charles Bustani, Republican from Louisiana, will host a town hall forum with Arab American community leaders. During the afternoon, the delegation will meet with the State Department and also address the issue of Arab Americans being evacuated from Lebanon. Are you going to be going to this?
No, I am not. I am going to be talking to our people here, trying to mobilize them, trying to organize them, trying to get our voices heard by the American public. I have already given up on the Congress of the United States. It's an occupied Israeli territory. We have 435, another incompetent Congress that is rubber stamping what the administration is doing when it comes to Israel. I think we're committing suicide as far as the U.S. in the region. Here, we have a policy. The United States, the Bush administration, has a policy, that declared policy. It says that we want to go out and gain the hearts and minds of Arabs and Muslims around the world. Is this how you gain the hearts and minds of Arabs and Muslims? By giving the Israelis an open, an invitation to and support, total support, to go and kill innocent people and destroy the infrastructure of a country? This is not the way you gain the hearts and minds of Arabs and Muslims. And whether Democrats or Republicans, they are committed to the help of the Israelis. They've been bought. Their soul has been bought. And therefore, talking to them is useless. Useless. We have to talk to the American people. We have to start talking directly to the American public and showing them the way to become a greater nation.
Osama Soleimani, you say the Congress is an occupied Israeli territory. Noam Chomsky says it's not so much the U.S. serving Israel's purposes as Israel serving U.S. purposes.
Well, where is the U.S. where is the U.S. service in here and the purpose in destroying Lebanon? I don't understand. I mean, this is making Syria stronger. This is making Iran stronger. Look, we went to war in Iraq in order to strengthen Iran. Iraq had stood against the Iranians, And Afghanistan, we went out to take Taliban that were standing against the Iranians. We are making Iran stronger in the region. It is our own policy that's making Iran stronger. And I tell you, you know, this is a failing policy. This is a policy that is going to pay dividends, negative dividends, to the American people in the long run. When they come and attack us again, I don't want to hear why do they hate us. It's very obvious why. Look at what's happening today and what we're doing today to the world, to the Arab world and to the Muslim world. And then the answer of why they hate us is very obvious.
Osama Sablani, I want to thank you very much for being with us, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Dearborn-based weekly bilingual newspaper, The Arab American. As we turn now to our last segment, today is the birthday of former South Dakota Senator George McGovern. He turns 84. He was the first senator to go to the Senate floor and demand an immediate end to the Vietnam War. These were tumultuous times. Martin Luther King had been assassinated. Robert Kennedy, who'd also run for president, had been assassinated. In 1972, McGovern ran for president on an anti-war platform. This is an excerpt of a documentary about his life called One Bright Shining Moment, The Forgotten Summer of George McGovern, produced by Steve Vittoria. I narrated this documentary.
It doesn't do much good to bomb a rice field or to drop bombs on a primitive agricultural country like Vietnam. We haven't protected our men in the South with the bombing. This is the biggest fraud ever perpetrated on the American people. We haven't saved the lives of American troops in the South by bombing the North.
You might say first that, you know, lies are natural
Howard
to
Zinn.
Governments. And this is true whether it's a totalitarian government or a democratic government. They lie most about war, because in war, there is the sharpest difference between the interests of the government and the interests of the people, because in war, the people will die.
If I died in Vietnam, I would die serving the country that I loved.
Ron Kovic.
And I think that millions of young men who went to that war felt that way. And we believed them. We trusted them. We had faith in what they said we had to do was the right thing. And we went to that war believing in our hearts that we were right and that our government would never lie to us.
They took all your dignity and all your sensitivity and just inexorably grind it out of you, strip it off of you, and they make you into a little zombie.
They used to say, contain China. Well, I said, all right, if you want to contain China, why are you hitting the Vietnamese, who have been China's enemy for 1,000 years?
Gore Vidal.
But you see, that's history, and the United States of Amnesia does not admit that there has ever been history or anything happening before Monday morning's New York Times, which is apt not to be historical.
And when the Vietnam War started, I found myself really feeling estranged, because I thought not only should we not be there, but if we're there, we should be on the other side.
Gloria Steinem.
So they couldn't think of a reason. It was containing China. They got tired of that one. And then I realized it was a war of imperial vanity. At least we are thieves in Iraq.
It's really alienating to feel that your country is at war and you think the other side has more merit.
The Lyndon Johnson people were pissant fools, to use his colorful language. They were just fools. How dare anybody stand up to us?
Take the camera out of Vietnam. It's just another war. There's something coming in my house, and these guys don't look like John Wayne.
Dick Gregory.
And they hollering and screaming. And you hear folk cussing, man. Get that motherfucking helicopter over here. You never heard this before.
I was a baseball player, so we got the war about 3 years late. I was
Jim
called a communist. I was known as the communist on the team, on the baseball team.
And then they made the mistake to sit and look at it with their children. Little children looking at Vietnam. We're not saying it's bad guy and good guy. They was looking, seeing people get killed. This was in your living room.
On a baseball team, anybody who, you know, gets caught reading a book or have an opinion on politics was a weirdo. So I was always considered a weirdo.
See, America have always had a nigger with us. And it would kick us and we'd get, oh, boss, did I do something wrong? Excuse me, boss. And he went over there, thought it was a nigger, and he kicked at him, and that Vietnamese grabbed his foot. Now, he never had his foot grabbed before in the history of America. and he ran across some niggas that wasn't scared of him.
He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.
In January of 69, Nixon and Kissinger told William Fulbright, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, just give us a year to end the war. And of course, the Democrats obliged. What's another year when it's not your kid's blood? American casualties continued, as high as 2,000 a week, with Nixon's bombing campaign intensifying to new levels. Deploring the killing, McGovern hit the Senate floor, calling for an immediate end to the war. Not one United States senator joined him. He was ridiculed on Capitol Hill and scorched by the press. During the 68 campaign, Nixon promised that he would unveil his secret plan to end the war. To this day, Nixon's secret plan has remained a secret.
The greatest honor history can bestow is the title of peacemaker. This honor now beckons America.
There are a lot of Americans who are not offended by the idea that we're at war and killing a lot of natives. There were still a lot of people who thought, yeah, pretty good thing, let's go get those gooks.
There has been and continues to be opposition to the war in Vietnam on the campuses and also in the nation. As far as this kind of activity is concerned,
Richard Nixon.
We expect it. However, under no circumstances will I be affected whatever by it.
The President of the United States said nothing you young kids would do would have any effect on him.
Dick Gregory.
Well, I suggest to the President of the United States, if he want to know how much effect you youngsters can have on the President, he should make one long-distance phone call to the LBJ Ranch and ask that boy how much effect you can have.
McGovern made a number of trips to Vietnam to see the battlefields firsthand, the jungles that were claiming so many lives. His first trip was in 1965.
I went to a hospital of American soldiers in Saigon. The very first person I talked to was a captain. And the nurse who was taking me around said the captain got the Silver Star and the Purple Heart. I said, well, congratulations, Captain. And as I did so, his lips started to quiver. And I looked down on the bed and his feet were gone. He had stepped on a mine and blown off his feet about 6 inches above the ankles. And I visited with him for a while and I said, well, congratulations again, Captain, on the Purple Heart this morning. He said, that's easy to get in this damn place. I went into a civilian hospital where the Vietnamese were being cared for. They were the victims of shrapnel from American gunfire. One woman had a baby that she was holding. The baby's head was completely wrapped in bandages except for the eyes. And I asked her if she would mind if I took a picture of her and the baby. She picked up an old rag to wipe some of the blood off the bandages on the baby's face and then tried to smile wanly, and I took that picture, which I still have.
George McGovern, he turns 84 today. The documentary is a bright, shining moment. It's produced by Steve Vittoria. And that does it for today's broadcast. We'll link to it at our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Gallet and Evan Reagan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.